Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk World Radio, we are talking about Native Nations, a millennium in North America. If you're watching the video, I'm holding it up. Native Nations, wonderful book. We are speaking with the author, Kathleen Duvall, who is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where she specializes in early American and Native American history. Kathleen Duvall is a Pulitzer Prize winner and a Guggenheim Fellow. Her website is at kathleenduvall.net. Kathleen, thank you very much for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thank you so much, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
I very much enjoyed the book. I think one of the points may be that often people want to avoid understating the destruction that's been done, the genocide in North America, and they end up saying things like the indigenous people were eliminated. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, that's right. I think the main problem of that is that it's just not true. So you're exactly right. There is fear for good reason of underestimating the tragedy and real, you know, crimes that were committed against Native Americans across time. But if that's the only story that people learn about Native Americans, they end up with something like Native Americans all, you know, got killed by Europeans, which has two problems. One is not true. And the other, it's not true that Native nations aren't still around. They are still around. There are more than 600 state and federally recognized tribes in the United States alone. And then it also still gives all of the action, all of the agency and motivation to Europeans. And that also is not true, right? Most important to know that Native nations are still around, that they survived all this, but also that they were important parts of history. You know, they did many, many things across time and still do that affect history.
And yet it is true that there was enormous death and destruction, and not just from disease, right?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things I try to stress in this book is that another problem that people can have, another misinterpretation, is by legitimately recognizing that smallpox and other diseases killed people, killed Native Americans across time, but putting so much emphasis on that, they forget to give a lot of the blame to Europeans and their descendants in the Americas as well, because Native Americans, like all early modern peoples, practiced the best kinds of things that you could do for disease, which is quarantine, right? We know quarantine is the only thing that works really well for new diseases that we don't understand. And basic nursing. And frankly, Native Americans in the 1600s, 1700s, they didn't have some of the really damaging medical practices that Western Europeans had that actually tended to make people worse. So yes, smallpox and other diseases hit hard, especially at first when maybe people hadn't faced that before. But those diseases also hit really hard in Europe and Africa and Asia. And when disease hit at a time when, say, Spanish people were enslaving large numbers of Native Americans, or they were in the middle of a war and it was really hard to have, really practice quarantine and basic nursing. That's when large numbers of Native Americans died. It was not disease alone. It was never disease alone.
So it's not that Europeans set foot on the continent and didn't really get around to colonizing until much later. And when they came back and started colonizing, 90% of the people were already gone. Rather,
right.
It was the later combination of violence and abuse and disease.
Exactly. Yeah, you put it perfectly in one sentence, like the very common sort of mistold story. And then the reality of that this, yeah, it took centuries for Europeans to colonize North America.
I think a lot of the key points in this book have to do with timing and misunderstandings of timing, including how recently various Native American peoples were prospering with relatively little contact with descendants of Europeans, and how recent a lot of the destruction was. Can you talk about the timing of things?
Yeah, that's really astute. Timing may be one of the biggest arguments of this book, right? That 1492 doesn't change everything. In fact, in 1750, right, almost 300 years after 1492, Most of the population of North America was still native. By 1850, right, which is not even that long ago from today, right, until after the Civil War, most of what's now the United States was controlled by Native people. So, yeah, it's late. For centuries, as you say, most Native nations, those in the interior of North America, so it's very different for people on the coast, especially those on the Atlantic coast who face large numbers of English settlers. In the interior, yeah, there are Native nations that, sure, they get metal tools and they get metal kettles and guns and horses early, but more than a century, in some cases centuries, they either don't need any Europeans at all, or they just come as a few traders now and then who are more useful than threatening.
When someone like Adolf Hitler is looking admiringly at the history of US treatment of native peoples in the 1920s, he's looking back just a lifetime or so at much of it, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's so eerie to read how he wrote about, yes, admiringly of the efforts at genocide that happened against Native Americans. But right, it is a late 19th century and even early 20th century phenomenon for the most part. There are places where, as I said, where colonialism hits hard and early, places like Virginia, North Carolina, and New England. But for most of the continent, that's something that happens in the late 19th,
Another,
second half of the 19th century. Yeah.
yeah. Another point I take from this wonderful book is that a lot of the interaction between European colonists and Native Americans, it was the latter who were primarily calling the shots, which I think could surprise a lot of people. Can you explain or give an
Right.
example or two?
You were talking about timing. One of the things I try to do in this book is slow things down. And so there are chapters that focus on the book moves forward in time chronologically, but chapters sort of sit with a place and a people and their native neighbors and Europeans as they come there. And several of the chapters kind of in the, I don't know, the, I don't know, in the middle of the book. And so, for example, when Dutch traders came to the Mohawk nation in the early 1600s, Mohawks recruited the Dutch. They, in fact, persuaded Dutch traders to build what later became Albany. And because they wanted trade with the Dutch, they wanted all kinds of goods that the Dutch brought. And so the Dutch would make law, they would make rules for the New Netherland Company, and they would say, okay, don't sell guns to Indians, right? That seems like a bad idea, right? And but Native people wanted guns, and the Dutch traders were there to trade, and so they weren't going to get any furs or leather, the kinds of things they wanted from the Mohawks, unless they gave the Mohawks what they wanted, and so they had to trade guns. Same thing ha happens with liquor. Same things ha happens actually with cake and bread. There are a series of petitions I came across by New Netherland settlers who complained to the New Netherland officials that they can't afford to buy white bread or cake or cookies because the Mohawks have so much market power in New Netherland that they buy up all of that stuff. So yeah, I think that's just one example of calling the shots for quite a long time.
Yeah. And numerous examples of native nations playing one European power off against another.
Right. Yeah.
They can make deals with who they want, right?
That's exactly right. And so in that case, the Mohawks are allying with the Dutch in part because their native enemies have allied with the French, and they're getting French weapons, and they've persuaded French soldiers to come fight with them. And so they actually Europeans get pulled into native wars that they don't want any part of, right? They're not there to fight. I mean, they want to reap resources, right? But they get drawn into these local politics and local wars.
Yeah, we are talking about the book Native Nations: A Millennium in North America with its author Kathleen Duvall. It does start way back when, and it proceed chronologically up to the present. If we go back to the beginning, to these ancient cities in Illinois and Arizona and Alabama, what should people know that most people don't?
Yeah, so I think first of all that there were large cities, sort of urban civilizations in North America 1,000 years ago. And they, at the time, their size, their development really was parallel to things going on in Western Europe at the time. Both were based on a sort of spreading large-scale agriculture that sort of allowed for the growth of cities. And then the second thing to know is that those cities fell. There was a time where the climate changed, it got colder, it moved into what climatologists call the Little Ice Age. And in North America, north of central Mexico, cities continue in central Mexico for that with the Aztecs and other peoples of central Mexico. But north of there, those great cities fell. And one of the things I look at in the book is sort of I combine archaeological evidence with oral histories that look back to this long ago time around the 1200s, 1300s. And it seems that people decided that these cities were not functioning well. There had been famines because of probably because of climate change and other things that were kind of falling apart. And Native people sort of spread out. They built more sustainable economies and more sort of what we would call consensus democracies rather than these cities with powerful political religious leaders. And so that's what Europeans encountered when they got here, were these sort of highly developed consensus democracies that not only farmed, but also they actually had started hunting and fishing and gathering more than their direct ancestors had because they felt that was a more sustainable, more diversified economy. And then Europeans just think that's primitive. They think they don't realize they've ever had cities. They don't realize that what they've developed is something that actually came out of that. And maybe in some ways it's more sophisticated, more complicated. They just saw them as sort of primitive hunter-gatherers.
I had read elsewhere that Cahokia, this enormous city across the river from what we call St. Louis, had been intentionally or otherwise forgotten, that there was no history of it. Was there an oral history that stretched back to then?
Yeah. So one of the things that happens, I think historians or non-Native historians thought that there were no oral histories of Cahokia that it did. But that was at this time we were talking about earlier in the late 19th century and early 20th century when really the US government was actively trying to destroy Native nations. And so Native people were not real big on sharing their oral histories in that time because for one thing, they've been told by the US government that they weren't even supposed to be doing that kind of thing anymore. They're supposed to become fully assimilated into American society and not continue their old ceremonies and traditions and things like that. But there are people who kept those oral histories alive. And more recently, they've started coming out. There have been really exciting new editions, published editions of oral histories where Native scholars are making those things available. And then there are also all these museums and cultural centers that tribes run that also sort of convey some of this long-held oral history to outsiders like us.
And Europeans, you know, not only plowed stuff under, but also just built over and pretended it wasn't there, right? And there was a farmer on top of the biggest pyramid who had to point out that this was maybe not natural.
That's exactly right. And that's, you know, these great cities, they were, you know, unlike great cities in other parts of the world, they were built on top of and around these earthen mounds, which are totally human made. I mean, they were constructed by human beings, but now that they don't have palaces and temples on top of them, they do kind of just look like big hills. And yeah, I couldn't believe I found that this couple named Mr. and Mrs. Hill lived on top of the largest 10-story tall mound in Cahokia.
And, you know, of course, when the British came, one of their ways to justify things to themselves was to say these people don't farm and therefore they don't improve the land and therefore it's not their land. And of course, they didn't want to own the land. They didn't have that same concept of owning land. But there was a lot more farming than Europeans told each other. How much farming was there in North America?
Lots and lots of farming. So I said, you know, that they had diversified their economies and they had relatively more hunting and gathering and fishing than they had in the past. But farming is the basis of Native American economies when Europeans get here and continues to be long after that. One of the things I think that makes that invisible, you're right, there's this motivation that makes it invisible. British people want to believe that Native people don't really own the land. But another thing is that in most Native societies, almost all Native societies, women were the farmers. And European men who came here tended not to see women's labor, women's really sort of central role in Native economies. They just looked at what men were doing, and they said, "Oh, the men are just hunting." And by then, in most of Europe, hunting was a sport for the elite. And so they think, you know, these men, what great lives they have. All they do is hunt. You know, they don't work that hard. And they didn't see the sort of labor that that was this kind of reciprocal labor of men's and women's work.
But also, the native societies had replaced these big cities with a more democratic, more egalitarian society that they consciously chose and supported and approved of and didn't aspire to hierarchies and kings. And this sort of view of the Europeans was, wow, there's a lot to admire here, this freedom, and what is this democracy stuff we've never heard of? But also, it's primitive, it's backward. They aren't capable of making higher societies. It's a very strange reaction, right?
That's right. And it's sort of, if you kind of wind it back and imagine, well, what if they had seen this as a higher development? Because eventually they themselves, as they move into Europeans and white Americans, as they move into the Enlightenment, they're going to think of democracy as the highest form of politics, right? But they don't think that in the early modern era. Monarchy or balanced monarchy maybe is the highest form. And yeah, they can't see Native Americans as, you know, maybe ahead of them in some things.
But even today, maybe because those hills last and pyramids and monuments last, we think of societies that build royal palaces as high culture, and
That's
farmers are somewhere down below that, and hunter-gatherers are, you know, off the chart, right?
That's exactly right. So yeah, well, maybe we've come around on democracy. Yeah, we still see cities as the highest form of civilization. Those, in fact, have the same, those words have the same root in European languages, right? City and civilization there. Yeah,
So
absolutely right.
we're talking about Native Nations, a millennium in North America with Kathleen Duvall. And there are a lot of great chapters in here on different nations around North America. As someone who talks with a lot of peace activists, there's a lot of admiration for the nations in Upper New York State, as we call it, the Mohawks and others, and they make peace. But it was really just peace within their coalition is sort of like the European Union getting the Nobel Peace Prize while attacking the world, right? It's peace only within the borders, right?
Right. If you talk to the Anishinaabe in the 1600s, they do not think of the Mohawks as peaceful people. They do not think of the Iroquois and Haudenosaunee as peaceful people. Now, what the Haudenosaunee would say is the peace is welcome to everybody. All you have to do is come into it. But that means being subordinate to the original nations, right? Maybe eventually you can be, and the Tuscaroras do become one of the main nations of the Haudenosaunee or Iroquois. But most of the people they fought against in the 1600s, early 1700s, didn't want to become part of that league. They wanted to maintain their own sovereignty and independence.
I live here in Charlottesville, Virginia, where it took a huge struggle to get a literally pro-genocide monument of George Rogers Clark taken down from the University of Virginia just recently. And Lewis and Clark themselves moved out of downtown and out to a park and so forth. The American Revolution is generally, you know, still a great, perfect, glorious thing in our schools. And it doesn't exactly look like that from a native perspective, right?
That's right. That's right. Now, I think it's important to know that there are many different native perspectives on the American Revolution, as in, you know, there are on everything. But there's, I think, one of the most important things for students to understand is during the American Revolution, there are Native Americans who live within and among colonists, and they tend to side with the colonists in the war. But there are also, most Native Americans are still an independent, sovereign, nations at the time of the American Revolution, and the ones who are on the border of the British colonies are very worried about British expansion, about colonists coming onto their land. So Shawnees and Delawares or Lenape, the Haudenosaunee we were talking about earlier, the Iroquois, in the southeast, Cherokees, Choctaws, Chickasaws, and Muscogee Creeks, they some of them want to stay out of the war completely. They see this as the revolution as a war between a king and his people, and you don't mess with that. You don't mess with a dad and his sons, right? You don't get in the middle of that. But others want to take advantage of this war, and they do end up siding with the British because they see the British as more likely to protect their land from the people they identify as the real problem, the settlers who are moving onto their land illegally. Illegally according to their own laws, Native Nations laws, and illegally according to the British Empire's laws.
And the British at the moment were not eager for more westward expansion, and they lost, and then came more westward expansion, right?
That's right. That's right. So the British are not eager for westward expansion because they have they've fought against the French in the Seven Years' War just before. They fought in Pontiac's War, and it's just too expensive and deadly, and they just don't have the resources. So they are more or less determined to, within their large empires, are claiming all of this land, have parts of it that are for Native Americans, for these still independent Native nations, even though the British see that as all under the British umbrella, the British Empire, and colonies, and that those should be separate, that colonists shouldn't be able to just go wherever they want, which is exactly not what the colonists believe, right? They believe that if it's British, we should be able to go there.
Yeah. There's so many interesting chapters in this book. We can't get to them all, but one that was very interesting had a lot about Tecumseh and his brother and this movement and the idea of uniting all these disparate Native nations against or resist the Europeans together, which was a very difficult thing for very, very different Native nations proud of their idiosyncratic traditions, right?
Right, exactly. So I think we, looking back from the 21st century, would be like, Tecumseh is right. Listen to him. You should, all Native nations should band together and protect a common land that the United States won't take. But he is saying this in the early 19th century, and most Native people, including his own people, the Shawnees, say, that doesn't sound right, because Native nations are as different from one another, they think, or almost as different from one another, they think, at the time, as they are from Europeans. And some of them have fought against each other. They speak many different languages from each other. They have had wildly different histories. And so one of the things I argue in the book is while that might seem short-sighted, like maybe they were wrong to not go with Tecumseh, in the long run, that insistence on actually being different kinds of people, having different languages, having different identities, that is what has helped to lead to today. There's still being such a diversity of strong, separate Native nations today. So today, if you talk to a Native American, their primary sort of way of identifying themselves usually will be their particular Native nation, their particular tribe. And then they're also a US citizen and a Native American. But they aren't a Native American without being a citizen of a particular tribe.
One of the nations that might have most vehemently said, we're less like you than like the Europeans, might have been Cherokees. It's a very interesting account in the book of the tragedy of the Cherokee people.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So the Cherokee leaders in the early 19th century, they believe the Cherokee Nation will continue to be entirely independent and on the border of the United States, that it won't be removed, that it won't be subsumed by the United States. And what they want to do is make sure that happens, to protect that. But they also want to be a 19th century nation on the stage with other nations, including the United States, including European empires, including other Native nations. And so they do some of the same kinds of reforms that the United States enacts at its creation, right? They make a constitution. They publish, there's a Cherokee Nation newspaper that they publish. They develop a syllabary for writing things down in their own language. But none of that protects them from the sort of violence of the United States in the 1830s.
And they, in great degree, accept the Christian religion and the English language as a second language, and writing and literacy and dressing like Europeans, and suing for their rights in court, not with
you know, knives
That's
and
exactly
axes
right.
and none of it, all the things that it's impossible for the native people to do, right? They do, and
That's
it isn't
exactly.
good enough. Like, it
Yes,
doesn't matter.
right. And it's sort of, it makes you think back and say, well, maybe it was all kind of hollow. These promises that Thomas Jefferson and others made that if you would do all these things, if you would stop hunting and you would start farming, right? As we already talked about, obviously they already farm. Or
Right.
if you would
There was nothing left to
civilize,
hunt, so they had to
right.
farm,
There's nothing
right?
else. There's one point where one of the U.S. officials says to the Cherokees, "You'll go west because you'll be able to hunt." And Elias Boudinot, who runs the newspaper, is like, "None of our families have hunted for a living in a couple of generations, right? It's not like that anymore." But yeah, at that time in the early 19th century, that's just not, nothing is good enough for the United States.
We have just a few minutes left. Kathleen Duval, there's so many other stories of the Plains Indians and the Indians of the Southwest, but what should people know about up to the current and the native peoples that are here right now in North America? And what, if anything, should people be doing? Is there late justice and decency possible?
Yes, I think so. I think one of the things I think is to say, at the very beginning of the interview, we were talking about sort of misconceptions of this big story. And I want people to see this as a hero story. Like, we still, great damage was done, great tragedy, real violence, especially in the late 19th century. And so I think that makes it even more impressive that Native nations survived that they exist today. And in fact, one of the things I think it's really important for people to know is there's a renaissance going on among Native nations today with cultural revitalization, returns to older traditions and practices of ceremony and art and craft, but also all kinds of new developments. If you I think most modern art museums in the United States have had an exhibit of contemporary Native art, right? Native artists are making, tremendously cutting edge art in today. And so I think for people who want to know kind of what to do, I think it's first is just recognizing that, recognizing Native sovereignty, Native diversity, that Native nations are different from each other, learning a little bit about the Native nations who either are around you or perhaps were removed from where you live. Most Native nations today have a website where you can see both their version of history, what they want to tell about their past, but also some of the exciting things that they're doing these days. And so I think knowing all of that and also realizing that Native nations are still here and they're going to be part of the solutions to any problems that we have in the United States.
What about seats at the United Nations?
Right. Well, the United Nations has made some declarations about rights of indigenous people. And I do think maybe that it would be the next step, maybe in our own Congress, maybe the United Nations ways of having actual representation by Native nations as sovereignties. Yeah, I think it's going to be really exciting to see what happens in the next couple of generations.
I'm glad to hear it. I cannot recommend highly enough. The book is called Native Nations, A Millennium in North America by Kathleen Duval. Kathleen's website is kathleenduval.net. We'll have the link up at talkworldradio.org. Kathleen, thank you very, very, very much for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thank you for all your terrific questions. What a great conversation.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.